You turn to Haggai in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, This people say, The time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed or ceilinged houses? This house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, Consider your ways." Let's get a little background before we proceed in here on the book of Haggai. First of all, the name Haggai comes from the Hebrew word hag, which is a feast or festival. This prophet was named specifically as a prophet of the Feast of Tabernacles. He is the prophet of the Feast of Tabernacles revelation. If we want to understand the Feast of Tabernacles, insofar as its application and fulfillment is concerned, we need to study the book of Haggai. The what to do of the Feast of Tabernacles is found in the law, of course, but Haggai is the prophet who actually applies it and puts it into perspective for us. The revelation that Haggai received here, as it says in verse 1, came on the new moon, which is the first day of the month, and a Sabbath, by the way, and it's the first day of the sixth month. Now, this would roughly correlate with our month of August, somewhere around the first to the middle part of August, sometimes the end of August when this would have been given. Haggai's prophecy here was designed to prepare the people for the feasts of the seventh month. That is the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles. Tabernacles, of course, is the culmination of the fall feasts, or the feasts in the seventh month. Haggai also has a message of timing. You'll notice in verse 2, this people say the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Haggai was differing with them. He was saying, yes, the time is come. Haggai deals with timing as well. And we'll see this as we go along, because Haggai's prophecy, I believe, is highly prophetic on a time cycle of 2,520 years. In other words, the things that Haggai was prophesying about was in the context of the temple, the rebuilt temple, or the second temple, after Solomon's temple was destroyed, and they were rebuilding this, well, in the days of Haggai and Zechariah. This was after the Babylonian captivity. The prophecies of Haggai, as we will see as we get into, especially into the second chapter, we'll see that the things that he was prophesying about concerning that temple and that Feast of Tabernacles was really not applicable at all to his day in that temple and in that feast day. It's applicable today with us in a new temple, you being the temples of the Holy Spirit, particularly in the corporate sense, because he is building a corporate body where the stones and pillars and foundations of this temple that is being built are people. We are the bricks or the stones, the living stones of this temple. The foundations are the apostles and prophets. The chief cornerstone is Jesus Christ himself. And so he is building this temple in a different sense. The patterns back in Haggai's day of building that particular structure on a physical level, those patterns were not the real temple that God was talking about in the word to Haggai, but yet those were patterns that were laid for a future temple, which is us, or a greater temple, a spiritual temple. I don't know if I'm saying that clearly or not, but this is basically the message of Haggai. It was a prophetic decree to finish the temple after starting it about 14 years earlier, 13 or 14 years earlier. It's led by the two witnesses of the day, Zerubbabel and Joshua. So you have the governor and the high priest. This is in verse 1 here. The governor and the high priest. You have the civil leader and the priest. Civil and religious leaders here. And on that level, it's a two witnesses type of theme. It's the same basic pattern as Moses and Aaron. Moses being the civil leader, Aaron being the high priest. It is also the same basic pattern as Moses and Elijah, in a sense, where you have the law and the prophets. The prophetic office was originally entrusted into the hands of the high priest, at least until the days of Eli, when it was taken, the prophetic office was taken from the priesthood and transferred to a separate office known as the prophetic office. That is, the prophetic office became an office as distinct from the priesthood in the days of Samuel. The prophetic office is a specialized type of priestly office or priestly function. The story of Zerubbabel and Joshua comes forward more in the book of Zechariah than it does in Haggai, although it does appear in Haggai as well. As for the timing of this prophecy, I believe that this is an important aspect of it if we want to understand the timing and application of Haggai's prophecy. It comes in the second year of Darius the king. This is not Darius the Mede, who took over in Daniel chapter 5 when Babylon fell. This is Darius the Persian. Okay? This is Darius the Great, who came into rulership in 521 BC, whereas Darius the Mede, who was ruling essentially under Cyrus and organizing the kingdom in Daniel's day, if you recall, occurred about, it occurred a few years earlier, okay, from 537 to 534 BC. But Darius the Great began his rule here in 521. 521 was the first year of his reign. So he actually came to the throne probably in 522 sometime when his predecessor died, Cambyses. That would be his accession year, so 521 would be the first year of his reign. Therefore, 520 is the second year of his reign, and that's what this is dated as. Now, how do we know these dates? How do we know that this is when Darius really came to the throne? Well, if you have read Secrets of Time on page 84, you'll notice the reign of Darius is dated according to two lunar eclipses. The lunar eclipses, according to historians, particularly Ptolemy of Egypt in ancient times, he says that Darius, during the 20th year of Darius, was a lunar eclipse, and also in the 31st year of his reign, you also have a lunar eclipse. That means that there was a lunar eclipse 11 years apart. It would be visible, of course, in the Middle East. Astronomers have been able to figure out precisely when that was. When was there an 11-year gap of lunar eclipses in any part of that time in history? They figured that out, that the 20th year of the lunar eclipse that occurred in Darius's 20th year was November 19 of 502 BC. And in the 31st year, the lunar eclipse occurred on April 25 of 491 BC. If the 20th year of Darius was 502 BC, then what was the first year of Darius? So you just go back, you back off 19 years, and you come to 521 BC is the first year of Darius. Now, why do we go to all that trouble to figure out exactly when this is dated? Well, it's like I've said many times, the date of a revelation usually has something to do with its fulfillment. And I found that to be in my personal life as well. That's why I always date a word that I get. And whenever somebody gives a revelation, I want to know, when did you get that revelation? And so many times it's not dated. And so it becomes almost useless to figure out when is this to be fulfilled. But if we date these things, and I date them not only with the day and the year, but I usually put it also the time of the day even. Because I've found that things are sometimes fulfilled a year, 2 years, or even 10 or 11 years later, right down to the minute even, when things are fulfilled. So here we have Haggai's prophecy that's coming in the second year of Darius. And of course, the second year of Darius is the year 520 BC. First year 521 BC and now 520. This is significant because it appears that the prophecies of Haggai are being fulfilled on a 2520 year fulfillment, which, since this is 520, if you add 2520, you know, it takes 520 years just to get to the year zero. Well, there's no year zero. Brings you to the year one. Okay, because it goes 1 BC to 180. Plus 2,000 years is the year 2001. Okay, 2001 AD. So I would expect to see, and again, this is a projection a few years ahead of us now, but I would expect to see Haggai's prophecies begin to come into fruition sometime in the year 2001. Of course, in the Hebrew time, 2001 really begins around September of the year 2000, right? So somewhere between September 2000 to September of 2001 is when I would expect to see these things, at least these would be watch dates for me. The prophecies are coming in the sixth month in order for them to be able to start preparing for the Feast of Tabernacles in the seventh month. So they're getting a one-month warning, if you will, to the Feast of Trumpets. The Feast of Trumpets comes on the first day of the seventh month. He gets his revelation on the first day of the sixth month. The Lord is giving them a 30-day warning, if you will, and that is what I would say is a time for them to decide whether or not they are going to be obedient to this word or not. Will they hear this word or will they not? And we find that indeed they do. Here's where they start to actually finish the work that had begun 14 years earlier. If you apply these time periods here on a 2520 year schedule, we find that the beginning of this work, or I should say the return from Babylon, when they began the work, which was 534 BC, has an equivalent 2520 years later to the year 1987, or from September of 86 to September of 87. That just happens to be the 120th Jubilee from Adam. Now that I find interesting because on this 2520 year cycle, Haggai was actually prophesying something a long time ago, but he's prophesying Jubilee stuff. The thing is, 534 BC, when the people were freed from Babylon and allowed to return, that was like a Jubilee. Every man returns to his inheritance. And this spoke of a Jubilee that would occur 2520 years later. It shows also the beginning of the building process, beginning to build the temple. But they didn't get much more than the foundations built. They laid foundations then, but then reality set in, I guess, and they decided they had to build their own houses, and so they got the building projects of their own houses, and they never really came back to this temple. 14 years later, from 534 to 520 BC. Haggai prophesies here. He gets this word. And if you add 14 years to this 1987, you come to the year 2001. So this goes September of 86 to September of 87 to 2000 to 2001. Okay, 14-year difference here. These are the years. It goes from September to September. I would suggest that this is the time that we need to be praying about and watching for the fulfillment of Haggai's prophecy. Now, I know it's a little early yet. This is only 1998. But then, so what? We can get a couple of years warning on this. 2.5, 3 years, head start on it, right? That way, if we are studying this thing, we can get a grasp on it, be praying about it, and we're just that much farther ahead when we come to the time of fulfillment. And also, remember, you don't have to wait for the year 2000 or 2001 to start preparing your temple. That's what we've been doing all along, right? I mean, we should be preparing now. At least on a personal basis, there is always something that we can do. Because on the personal side of this, of the fulfillments, now is the time, and it always has been the time. Okay? People in the Middle Ages, they too should have been preparing their own temples. The apostles in Jesus' day and during the time of the book of Acts, of course. Every individual is on his own time schedule with God, and God has been building the temple in them as well, on a personal level. But then there is a corporate level where we have a corporate fulfillment. Because in one sense you are the temple, in another sense you're only one stone of that temple. You have to learn to think in both ways. There is a personal application, but you are not all it. You are also only one stone of a temple. And until all the stones have been prepared, it is not going to be put together. You recall when Solomon's temple was built, because again, this is also a pattern of Solomon's temple. In Solomon's temple, all of the stones were prepared off-site. Right? There was not a sound of a hammer or chisel on the whole temple site. They were all quarried way out there somewhere. And it was a hidden work, in other words. It was not a public thing, it was a hidden work. But when all the stones were completed, when all that was done, then they brought it all in and they constructed it very quickly, like very quickly. If you can think of yourself as one of those stones over there in the quarry, that's the personal work where they go from one stone to another stone to another stone and they complete each one. In every generation, there are a certain number of stones that have been polished and sanded and chiseled and prepared to fit perfectly upon each other in this temple. But then they sit there in the quarry waiting for the rest of the stones to be completed. No matter what each of those stones may do, no matter what they think, they may get impatient. They might want to think that they're part of the temple now. They're not a part of the temple until all the stones are completed. And then they all come and are put together at the same time. There is the corporate fulfillment. And there's where we find the purpose of timing is, to find out when all these stones are to be put into one body, whereas before they've just been individualized. Does that make sense? This term remnant is very interesting because it's the same word as leaven. Leaven? What in the world? You'd think that this would not be the remnant. This would be everybody but the remnant. But it's not. The remnant that is to return after the captivity. This is Isaiah's theme. The remnant that is supposed to return, the primary return is returning to God in Isaiah. It's not so much a return from one location to another, like from Babylon to Jerusalem. Although it was manifested in that particular way. But in Isaiah's prophecies, the real focus is returning to God. In other words, repentance. Why is that necessary? It's because even the remnant is leavened. Okay? They're a part of a leavened body that went to Babylon to start with. And we're all a part of that remnant, if you will, or part of that lump. We're all coming out of Pentecost, which is a leavened feast, right? But to return, the leavened ones must return. That's another way of saying that Pentecostals must return to God. I know, Pentecostals think that they're pretty good, right? But the problem is they don't know that they're a leavened bunch. Of course, we're aware of it because we've done a lot of studies on this. We see how Pentecost works. And we are still in the transition coming out of Pentecost, but it's that because we are coming out of Pentecost, we are also coming out of the leavened state. But how do you do that? Well, you get baked in the fire. If you weren't leavened, you wouldn't need baking in the fire, right? The whole idea behind getting baked in the fire is because you're leavened. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with being leavened in Pentecost, because during the age of Pentecost, this was expected. This is what God was doing at that time. But if we stay there, then we have a problem. If we prefer to be leavened, it's a big problem. If we want to stay at the base of the mount instead of going up into the mount, into the fire of God to get baked, there's a problem. God expects us to be leavened to start with. That isn't the problem. God understands that because, after all, He created us this way. And in this Pentecostal age, He expects us to start out leavened. But He doesn't expect us to stay there. The remnant doesn't want to stay there. The remnant has a vision of something greater, which we call the Feast of Tabernacles. The rest of the church, though, who are blinded, do not have this vision. They don't share it. And they think they're doing pretty well just the way they are. So that's where the problem lies. But this is essentially a timing factor of when is God actually working on a corporate level to take all those living stones and put them together into a single body, if you will, this spiritual temple that He is raising up. I suppose keep your finger in Haggai, and let's look in the book of Ephesians just to lay the foundations here of New Testament scripture. In Ephesians 2, beginning with verse 19, it says, "Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for a habitation of God through the Spirit." Now, Paul doesn't really get into the difference and distinctions between the personal aspect and the corporate aspect, but he does show that it's a process. And whether it's personal or corporate, it is a process. For you personally, He is building you, He is shaping you as a living stone. And sometimes we say, ouch, when the chisel hits. So that's a process of time in your own life, but it's also a process of time in a greater sense, because He is doing many stones, will fitly frame them together at the proper time when all things are ready to go. It's kind of like a prefab building. The temple is like a prefab building. But you know, it was the same thing with the temple or the tabernacle in Moses' day. In Moses' day, they prepared all the curtains and all of the posts and all the foundations and all of the stones. They did all this over an entire winter or an entire, from about the Feast of Tabernacles to the spring. And then on the first day of the first month, they put it all together and they erected this tabernacle. But you see, they didn't erect the tabernacle until everything was prepared, and that took time. So, it's kind of the same thing as with Solomon's temple. If we want to know the purpose of time, it takes time to prepare the vessels to takes time to prepare the living stones. Then at the appointed time, they are all put together. I hope that's clear, because sometimes some people have a little hard time with timing. They don't know really, they think everything is now. In one sense, things are now. On the personal level, it is now. Now is the time of salvation. Now is the time to get prepared. Now is the time for the chiseling. Now is the time to get it baked in the fire. It's always now in that sense. But in the corporate sense, there is an appointed time. Well, you know, if you really boil it down, there is an appointed time in our lives too. Because there's many people who do not have the revelation of God until they're later on in life. But yet, when they come to know Him and they see how God has led them throughout their whole life, then they realize He'd been preparing them all along for an appointed time where you meet Him. See, and you meet Him, you get the revelation, your eyes are opened, you come to Him, and that too is an appointed time. So even in the personal sense, there is time, but it's less pronounced, or it's on a different level than it is when we're dealing with the corporate. Now Haggai, I believe, is primarily dealing with the corporate, although, of course, you can take some of these principles and apply them personally, obviously. The people said that the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. And the word of the Lord came to Haggai and said, "Is it time for you to dwell in your own well-built houses with ceilings and everything, but yet the house of God is laid waste?" The people never had any trouble believing that that it was time to build their own house. They just didn't know that they ought to be building God's house too. So they had time to decorate their own houses. This wasn't just basic structure. We're talking about they had time and money to really devote to this. They got their priorities wrong, in other words. I can see that we need priorities in, you know, we've got to have a house to live in, you know, while we're building this. Do you really need to put all your time and effort into all the decorations and lawn furnishings and everything else and say, oh, you just got to wait a little while longer until I build this extra room and I do this decoration and do all this wood carving and so? No. Do we really need to do all that before God's house is built? No. See, there comes a point where the priorities are wrong. It's okay for the people to build their own house, I think. I don't think that was the real problem. But they should have also been thinking, I want to complete this house as quick as possible so I, you know, get on to building the house of God. But then they kind of lost interest, and here it is 14 years later, and they still haven't started building. Well, what house is it that Haggai is really talking about? Because, you know, God is building a house, and we mentioned this before. Let's look at Psalm 127 for a minute, and let's take a look at this. In Psalm 127, this is one of the Songs of Degrees. It starts out, "Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them." Building a house, a quiver in the Hebrew, a quiver was considered to be the house of the arrows. The arrows were the sons. In the symbolic language and figurative language in Hebrew, the sons, or the arrows were sons, the quiver was the house. So in building this house, it is really a house for the sons of God. It's really what we're talking about. This is something that God has to do, because this is His house. He is raising up children. He is the one responsible to bring us into the disciplines whereby we may come into full maturity. Because it's the law that disciplines us while we are minors that brings us into Christ, or brings us fully into the anointing Christ. You see, the anointing that we have as full-fledged sons of God. Paul talks about this in the huiothesia, or the adoption of sons, which is the ceremony at the full maturity of the sons. So this is what I believe that this house is talking about. And this house is laid waste in the sense that, I suppose in the same sense that Sarah was barren and Rachel was barren, and, you know, there's always this barrenness that took place prior to the birthing of the son. It's the same kind of, the same pattern, really. But in the meanwhile, in spite of the barrenness, you have other children coming forth. Not the inheritors, but nonetheless, other children come forth on a lesser level. Take, for instance, Sarah. You have Sarah and Hagar. Hagar had a son named Ishmael. He was not the inheritor, but he was the firstborn. And when he was 14 years old, then Isaac is born, the inheritor. Well, here we're talking about a 14-year cycle again, right? 520 or 534 to 520 BC correlates with 1987 to 2001. It's a 14-year cycle again. 14 is the number of salvation or deliverance. In this sense, the deliverance of the sons, and it does have to do with the birthing of, how should I put it, the deliverers, the saviors. The last verse in Obadiah says that saviors shall come upon Mount Zion. Saviors. This, I believe, pictures the time of the judges, because the time of the judges, these judges were those who delivered the people from the hand of their captors. They were saviors in that sense. And in the same sense, those who are coming into full sonship are the ones who are the saviors, plural, of the earth. But the only way they can do that is if they have the headship, which is the Savior, who is Jesus Christ. In other words, it's this birthing is also a time when the body and the head are joined together to make a complete body. Jesus, the head, the firstborn son, is also the head. And then his body is brought to birth later according to the same pattern. And when they're joined together, which is an appointed time thing, being joined together, now the nerve connection between the head and the body is set up where the body can actually do the work that the head tells it to do. See, on a corporate level. We're not dealing individual here, because individually, obviously, we're already joined to the head. But again, on the appointed time corporate level, this yet has to take place on a higher level. So anyway, getting back to Haggai. Our time is almost up here. This book here is Haggai. This is a prophecy of the Feast of Tabernacles. His name means the feast day. It comes from the word Hag, or Hag, which is feast or festival. His prophecy here is a prophecy of the manifestation of tabernacles. And I believe that the key here is to understand the 2520-year time cycle. There are many 2520-year cycles, because there's many beginning points and many ending points. It really begins with the first captivities of the house of Israel in 745 BC. You go 2520 years later, you come to the year 1776. You know, the beginning of regathering the house of Israel and the formation of a new nation under God. First time since the days of Moses that a nation was actually formulated and brought into being under God, where God was actually, or where Jesus Christ himself was actually declared to be king. And the Supreme Court ruled that we were a Christian nation from the foundation. Now, I know we're a long ways away from that because we were still operating in the days of Pentecost. So, you know, what started is certainly greatly leavened by this point. I know that. Nonetheless, by a 2,520-year cycle, it links America's beginnings with the first beginnings of the downfall of the house of Israel. 2,520-year cycle. If you have read my book on the seven churches, you'll also see that, I believe, was the beginning of the Philadelphia church. And it started in Philadelphia on July 4, 1776. And interestingly enough, Philadelphia was actually our first capital until the year 1800, right? So, 1776 to 1800, if you take these dates and add 2,520 years, it comes to, or I should say subtract, you go back 2,520 years, is 745 to 721 BC. This was the length of time that it took for the house of Israel to fall. The captivities began in 745 BC. Samaria fell in 721 BC. That was the completion of it. Interestingly enough, that is the time of Philadelphia. And prophetically speaking, when you're dealing with the Old Testament and the New Testament church, the seven churches of the Old Testament and the seven churches of the New Testament, in the Old Testament, Philadelphia is the Hezekiah church. And you'll see references to this also in the book of Revelation when it deals with this church of Philadelphia. But Hezekiah was the king who was there during the deportation of the house of Israel. The house of Israel was deported, or I should say Samaria fell in the fourth year of Hezekiah. Hezekiah is what I would call the representation of the church leading up to the captivity church of Laodicea. Anyway, those are all further studies that you can do on your own if you just read the book on the seven churches. That Haggai is the prophet of timing. What he was doing in building this, or getting the people to rebuild or finish the building of the old temple, I believe that there is going to be a fulfillment 2,520 years later. Now, we know the foundations were laid in 534 and 533 BC, shortly after their arrival in the land, in Jerusalem, after their 70-year captivity, when the Edict of Cyrus went forth, allowing them to return. This correlates specifically with 1987, or really from 86 to 87, the 2,520th year. Here would be the beginning of the return, and by the fall of 1987, the temple would have been begun. That was then also the time when Gorbachev, on the 70th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, announced a whole new program, Glasnost, as he called it, in his speech to the Supreme Soviet on the 70th anniversary, which, of course, in years following, resulted in the complete disintegration of the Soviet Empire. This occurred after 70 years of the Russians' captivity to the Bolsheviks, who had taken over in 1917. So that particular date of 1987, or I should say 1917 to 87, was a correlation, or was a parallel 2,520 years after the captivity of Jerusalem from 604 to 534 BC. Well, after the people had gotten through building a little bit, laying the foundations and building an altar and so on, the opposition from the residents around them caused the building to cease. It wasn't until the time of Haggai, in the second year of Darius, 520 BC, that they resumed building again. And it took 5 years for them to complete it in 515 BC. So we're expecting to see the actual parallel of this from the year 2001 to the year 2006, at which time this whole cycle here should be complete. Now, this is somewhat long range. We're not dealing with the next year or two, except the next year or two, I think we're going to see a setup of this in one way or the other. There's a lot of good news and bad news. You know, there's a lot of things to be considered, a lot of things happening in the next couple of years, and has already begun, in fact. 2006 should see the completion of this cycle, at which time God needs a priesthood for this temple. Now, I don't believe that he's establishing a Levitical priesthood anymore. The book of Hebrews makes it very clear that there is a better high priest and a better priesthood, a better covenant, a better temple. Everything is better than it was before, and we're not going to go back to what it was before. If he did, that would be establishing something that's now worse, right? If what we got now is better, then to go back to what it was is worse. Well, God doesn't do that kind of stuff. He doesn't regress. He's doing something better. But what is he exactly doing? Well, there is a Melchizedek priesthood that he talks about in the book of Hebrews, quoting from the Psalms. This order of Melchizedek, if you read the account, the greatest significance of it is that it's cut loose from genealogy. It's not based upon your being born of the house of Levi anymore. It's based upon other things. Jesus, being a Judahite, received the high priesthood, even though he was not really a Levite. Oh, he might have had some Levitical blood, of course. I'm sure there was some crossover in the tribes. But as they reckoned the tribeship, he was not of Levi. He was of Judah. He was a lion of the tribe of Judah. So technically, he would have been ineligible by law to be a high priest, which he was. He was ineligible to be a Levitical priest, but he is eligible as a high priest of the order of Melchizedek, and that's different. God is raising up a new priesthood, and it is a better priesthood that is made up of people who are what the book of Revelation calls the overcomers, to them that overcome, those who qualify, as it says, for the first resurrection, quote unquote, in Revelation 20. I wondered about this priesthood here for a while, because I also mentioned before how we are seeing a 50-year pattern in this 120th Jubilee, or I should say the 121st Jubilee. Ever since the fall of 1986, which was the 120th Jubilee from Adam, 120 being the number always associated with the outpouring of the Spirit, 1986 was the Jubilee. The church did not declare it because they didn't know anything about it, but God had actually prophesied in the Scriptures that he would allow the overcomers to prophesy this in 10 years later. 10 years late, as it were. It's what we call the Hezekiah factor. We spent a couple of chapters in the Secrets of Time writing about that. So it was actually done in 1996, which really established the 1986 Jubilee. But meanwhile, we're in this 121st Jubilee. And in this Jubilee, we find that, well, let's go back to Numbers chapter 4, verse 3, where the law tells us a little interesting detail here. And I believe it's prophetic. In Numbers 4, it starts out saying, "And the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, Take the sum of the sons of Kohath from among the sons of Levi, after their families, by the house of their fathers, from 30 years old and upward, even until 50 years old, all that enter into the host to do the work of the tabernacle of the congregation." And this is repeated about 4 times in this chapter, verse 23, verse 35, and verse 43. And verse 47, it repeats this, from the age of 30 to the age of 50. And then the priest was to retire at the age of 50. Of course, I know under our Babylonian system, it's kind of difficult to retire at 50. But under God's system, this can be done. And you can enjoy your later years from 50 on and help raise the children, I guess. We can see that 50 is a year of Jubilee. In the establishment of this Jubilee here, we see that from 1986 to the year 2036, which is the 121st Jubilee, we have a 50-year period, and it's almost like this priest was born in 1986. That is, the sons of God, who are to be priests of God and of Christ and reign with Him, really born in like 1986 in this sense. In 1998, being 12 years old, we have to be about our Father's business, okay? At the age of 20, we come to the year 2006. Now this priest is 20, and in 2016, he's 30, then he retires in the year 2036. So it would appear from what Moses said, in Moses' pattern, that the time of ministry of this priesthood, the real ministry here, begins in the year 2016 when he turns 30. Or you can look at it, there's another verse in there which says that they actually started their apprenticeship 5 years earlier, and that would be the year 2011 at the age of 25. But they weren't considered to be full priests and therefore were not numbered among the priests until they were 30. But I was saying, well, wait a minute now. If the temple is completed in the year 2006, prophetically, how is it that we don't get a priesthood until the year 2016, or at the very earliest, 2011? It's 5 years late. What's going on? This past week, I just happened to run across something which I found quite interesting. 1 Chronicles chapter 23. I believe this gives us the answer. In the days of David, David got all the revelation and the plans for his son to build a temple, which we call Solomon's Temple. But David got all the revelation about this. Now, the dimensions and the patterns which God showed David were generally twice the size of the original tabernacle. Where did David get this revelation to build a temple rather than a tent and make it twice the size and have like 10 candlesticks instead of one, you know, and actually to change the dimensions and structure of the Ark of the Covenant? Under Moses, the Ark of the Covenant showed the two cherubim over the mercy seat, which had their wings touching, and they were bowing over the mercy seat, hovering over it. But in Solomon's temple, the two cherubim were standing with their wings outstretched, touching each other, the full width of the temple. Now this was contrary, or this was different, I should say, from the revelation that Moses had. In other words, God changed the law, if you will, or he changed the form. Because these things are prophetic, and it shows a progression of the kingdom. So also did David get a revelation to change the particular priesthood. Instead of having 12 princes of the tribes, now they had 24 governors. They doubled the number of governors. And we find here in verse 3 of 1 Chronicles 23, says, now the Levites were numbered from the age of 30 years and upward, and the number by their poles, man by man, was 38,000. Well, 38 is the number of captivity or bondage, right? They were 38 years in the wilderness. 38 is quite interesting. You know, the man who was sick in the book of John had been sick for 38 years, and then Jesus came and healed him. So this Levites here just happened to be 38,000 But then if you drop down to verse 24, it says, these were the sons of Levi after the house of their fathers, even the chief of the fathers, as they were counted by number of names by their polls, that did the work for the service of the house of the Lord from the age of 20 years and upward. What? Wait a minute here. What's going on? Is this a misprint or what? Well, keep reading. For David said, the Lord God of Israel hath given rest unto his people, that they may dwell in Jerusalem forever. And also unto the Levites, they shall no more carry the tabernacle, nor any vessels of it for the service thereof. For by the last words of David, the Levites were numbered from 20 years old and above. Last words of David. So, what is this? This is the time dealing with the building of the new temple, which, of course, they built in a physical structure in Solomon's day, but it was actually prophetic of our own day. There is a new temple being built. And guess what? They even changed the age of the priests who minister. So that was the tabernacle of David that the book of Acts was talking about. The tabernacle of David was the precursor to the temple of Solomon. Just like Moses had a tabernacle that was a precursor to the temple of Solomon, so also did David have a tabernacle that preceded the temple of Solomon. And I believe that the church in the wilderness, not only under Moses, but also in the New Testament, under Moses it was 40 years, in the New Testament it's 40 jubilees. This was also the time of the building of the tabernacle of David. But it's a precursor to the temple of Solomon. 2006, then, is 20 years from 1986. Basically, the priesthood reaches the age of 20 in the year 2006, and that's why it correlates 2,520 years after Haggai, and the temple was built back in Haggai's day, in 515 B.C. to 2006 A.D. So it correlates very well, you see. So that was a loose end that I didn't know about when I did part one of this, and now I can see what's going on here a little easier. It's remarkable what happens when you pray for a little insight, you know. Suddenly, it just happens to fall in your lap here. So the new age of priests here being 20. Now again, just so you all understand, we're not talking about the literal age of priests. We're talking about spiritual age of full maturity. The age of 20 was normally a time of kind of a rule of thumb of the time of the huiothesia in the New Testament, the adoption of sons. It's when a son came into full age and was given the full responsibility where he could, you know, whatever he signed his name to was binding upon the whole estate and his father. It was coming of legal age. It's generally about the age of 20, although it was up to the discretion of the father. He could withhold it completely from one of his sons if they weren't very reliable, or if they were going to spend their inheritance on riotous living, they could do that. But normally, 20 is considered the full age of maturity. And also, I think this is foreshadowed in Numbers 4, because the priesthood there, when it talked about the age of 30 doing the work of service in the temple, the literal Hebrew is warring the warfare, the work of service. It's military service is what it's called, really. We know, of course, that in the law, the age of military service was the age of 20. So it's almost like it inevitably had to come back from 30 to 20 in the priesthood, because they were warring a warfare every time they did the work of the ministry in the temple. It was spiritual warfare. It's one of the main laws of spiritual warfare. You'll find, not the laws, but the patterns of spiritual warfare in its application are found right here in Numbers chapter 4. The actual laws of warfare are in Deuteronomy 20. Most of them are. But we're not dealing with physical age any more than we are physical warfare. We're dealing with spiritual warfare and the work of the ministry, which is the same thing. Because essentially, doing the work of the temple is spiritual warfare. It's spiritual warfare on behalf of the whole nation. Because the temple that is built is always a representation of the spiritual condition of the nation or the people to whom it's applicable. That's why you had a progression from Moses to Solomon. It was a progression of the kingdom. But Solomon could not build his temple until David had done his work. It had to be a Tabernacle of David experience, which preceded the temple work, in order to bring them into a higher level of spiritual maturity. But now we have come to a new place in time where we have no longer physical temples, but spiritual temples, where the church is not a denomination or a building or an organization that is legally established with assets and members and steeples and buildings and all that kind of stuff. That's not what church is. Church is people. People meet in buildings, perhaps, but the buildings are not the church. The church, as defined by the IRS, is a building with assets and members. But the church, as defined by the Bible, is people. So we need to be sure we keep our definitions straight. So anyway, I just wanted to make that correlation with the year 2006. And again, of course, we're dealing with a time that's perhaps 8 years away. But nonetheless, I think that there is going to be a real work that in some form or other begins in the year 2001, a priesthood work, but it is going to be a building work, a preparation work of some sort of concentration of spiritual work that we've not even entered into yet. And I don't really even know what it is yet. But I think that that's something that we need to watch and see, because when it happens, then we'll say, ah, yes, this is what is happening. Now I understand what this new calling is, what this whole thing is about. Meanwhile, it is time to prepare for these things. Learn what's going on. Find out what God is doing in the earth so that we are not caught unawares like those who walk in darkness, as Paul says. These things come upon them as a thief in the night. You know, when they're all sleeping soundly and they're totally, totally startled, baffled by these things when they come to pass. If we know the patterns and can see the patterns ahead of time as the Lord shows us, then we can see that we can prepare ourselves mentally, spiritually, perhaps in some ways physically even, for this kind of a thing. Okay, with that, let's go back to the book of Haggai and keep going. You didn't know all that was in the first chapter of Haggai, did you? Well, leave it to me to make it complicated. In chapter 1, there was something that Haggai said here. Let's begin with verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 3. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your ceilinged houses, or your decorated and adorned houses, and this house, that is God's house, lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Check out the evidence to see if the timing is not yet right. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. I know, we all have holes in our pockets when it comes to money, right? Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith the Lord. That is a reference really to Solomon's temple, because after Solomon's temple was completed, God came down and filled that temple. And the priests couldn't even go in because the presence of God was so strong in Solomon's temple. And that, of course, occurred on the eighth day of Tabernacles, when Solomon's temple was glorified. That's the prophesied day of the outpouring of the Spirit in its fullness. Pentecost is the outpouring of the Spirit in its earnest, or down payment, the beginning of it. But eighth day of Tabernacles is the fullness of the Spirit that's to be poured out. And that, of course, I believe has yet to come on a corporate level. Verse 9, you looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith the Lord of hosts, because of mine house that is waste, and you run every man into his own house. Therefore, or that's why, the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. And I called for a drought upon the land and upon the mountains, and upon the corn and upon the new wine and upon the oil, and upon him which, and upon that which the ground bringeth forth, and upon men and upon cattle, and upon all the labor of the hands. Okay, there is a drought, which first of all is a drought of spiritual understanding and a drought of hearing the word. The book of Amos talks about this. He says that in that day there's going to be a famine in the land, not a famine of food, but a famine of hearing the word of God. And so people will run everywhere trying to get a real word from God, trying to get some real meat of the word and sustenance, and they're not going to be able to find it. It just isn't there. And of course, we see this all over the country. It seems like nobody really knows what's going on in the world. People run here and there. If people get a 20-minute sermon, they're looking at their watch to see if the chicken's burning. If you go a half hour, to save the ham for, you know, if they get a 45-minute sermon, my goodness, they're starting to panic. They can't handle more than a child can handle. You know, when they make movies, they make them for 12-year-olds. That's what they say. They gear them for a 12-year-old because that's the average mentality of the American populace. And they have to change the scene every, 6 seconds at the maximum? Because otherwise, if you have the same sequence of a camera, the people will start to get bored after 6 seconds. That's the mentality of the people today. They cannot focus on any one thing for very long, and especially the scriptures. You start to get into in-depth Bible study and nobody knows what's going on and everybody's lost right away, and then what happens? They're gone. Can't handle it. Of course, I know that's we've trained you folks pretty well now. You know, we tie you to the chair and you don't have any choice but to listen to an hour and a half. Well, I'm sure you all remember the days. Most of you have been in those days where, 10 minutes overtime was way too much already. And you just can't handle it. It's too overwhelming. You know, you get two facts put together and it overwhelms you. Well, let's look at this law again, or this, let's look at the law. Haggai here, when he gives the evidence of these things, he's really quoting from the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy and the 26th chapter of Leviticus. So if you'll keep your finger in the book of Haggai, let's go to Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, and let's compare what's going on here. You'll see what he's really talking about. These two chapters deal with the blessings of obedience and the curses for disobedience. By the way, these chapters do not deal with your justification by faith. It deals with your obedience. And that's two totally different things. Not justification, but sanctification. Well, and even sanctification is not strictly by your performance either. I know that. But nonetheless, it deals with your obedience. In Leviticus 26, let's start with Leviticus 26. It says in verse 3, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage shall reach unto the sowing time. You shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land safely. And I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. I will rid evil beasts out of the land, neither shall the sword go through your land. You shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. And 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. For I will have respect unto you, and make you fruitful, and multiply you, and establish my covenant with you. And you shall eat old store, and bring forth the old because of the new. Now, you'll have to actually get rid of the old, because you'll have much more than you can handle, and you'll say, well, hey, why should I eat the old crop when I've got the new one here? It'll last you beyond into the new crop. And I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you, and I will walk among you and will be your God, and ye shall be my people. Remember back in the book of Exodus, when the people worshiped the golden calf, what did God do after they had worshiped the golden calf? In Exodus 33, verse 7, it says, "And Moses took the tabernacle and pitched it outside the camp, afar off from the camp, and called it the tabernacle of the congregation." The word congregation there, in the New Testament, in the Greek, it's ekklesia or church. The tabernacle of the church. And it came to pass that everyone which sought the Lord had to go out unto the tabernacle of the congregation, which was outside the camp. You know, the church has worshipped the golden calf again under Pentecost, there at the base of Mount Sinai, where that first day of Pentecost, where the God came down and spoke to them the law on the day of Pentecost. And the people, right after that, started worshipping the golden calf. And this has been the history of the church of the New Testament as well. So what has happened as a result of that? God has taken His presence, His tabernacle, and He has pitched it outside the camp. And if you want to find God, you're going to have to find Him outside the church. Now, there is a sorry state of affairs. But it's happened all over again. This same pattern is repeated in the New Testament church. You won't find hardly any truth at all, other than a few scraps here and there, in the church. Yeah, this is what it says in Hebrews too. In the book of Hebrews, I think it's chapter 13, it quotes this in the context of having to leave the temple in Jerusalem. You have to go outside of the established religious order, which they called the church back then. That was Herod's temple. And Paul says, or whoever wrote Hebrews says, you have to go outside the camp in order to find God, because they had worshipped the golden calf, essentially, worshipping gold. But look at all we can do with money. Oh boy, therefore we got to raise $8 million or I'm going to die tomorrow. Or something like that. I mean, it's incredible what has happened to the church, at least in this century. We have the same problem again. In Paul's day, they had to leave the old order of the Passover order and come into the Pentecostal order. But now we must leave the Pentecostal order and come into the Tabernacles order, because there were 3 feasts, not just 2. Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. So what Paul applied in his day to leaving the old temple order and coming into a new temple is also applicable, and it's especially applicable today, because the church has its sights set way back on the old site of Jerusalem again. They want an old temple built again. They got all their trust put in that. And what is that? That's the very thing that Paul says, you got to get outside the camp in order to find God. What do you want to do? Build a temple back there? Have Levite priests again? Sacrificing animals again? I mean, what is this? I find that really incredible. But I've had people actually tell me that, yes, God is going to set up blood sacrifices all over again. And I say, really? Why in the world did Christ even come and die? That seems kind of strange to me. But anyway, difference of opinion here. In Leviticus 26 again, verse 11, he says, "And I will set my tabernacle among you." In other words, the solution is, if you will be obedient, then I will set my tabernacle among you again. You want real revival. You want the presence of God. You got to be obedient to Him. You can't just say, hey, I'm saved, therefore I have the right to have the presence of God. That's not how it works. God is building a tabernacle again. He's building a temple, actually, but it's really the same thing. He's building a temple again. And He's building it among us. And this time, do you want His tabernacle to be built among you, in you? It's obedience that's required. And He says, and I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people. Do you want to be God's people? Well, here's what it says. It's obedience. You see, there were a lot of people who came out of Egypt, but very few who went into the promised land. And that was the church in the wilderness, as Acts 7:38 says. That was the church. And we have the same situation all over again. A lot of people got justified by faith in the blood of the Lamb. Oh, yes, we came out of Egypt. We came out of the world. Here we are. We're justified by faith. We even got baptized. You know, we crossed the Red Sea. And some say, yeah, we all went all the way to Pentecost. We got the baptism of the Spirit. You know, we came down to Mount Sinai. But you know, they have a tendency to build a house there in the wilderness. And they never get to the promised land. It's not who came out of Egypt. It's who gets into the promised land. That's really where it's at. And again, in New Testament terminology, it's not who gets saved. It's who comes into the Feast of Tabernacles. You get saved at Passover, that's fine. You get filled with the Spirit with Pentecost, and that's good too. But do you want to stop there? Do you really want to stop there? No. You haven't received the full promise until you have entered the promised land. And that is a Feast of Tabernacles phenomena. So we need to know about these things. And I know I hammer it quite a bit because it really all boils down to the feast days all over again. Because these are the original prophecies of the Bible. If you want to know anything about timing or of the Christian experience and the levels of growth and spiritual growth, the way to the promised land is mapped by the feast days of Israel. The feast days. This is what the original prophecies were. And it also tells you about the first coming of Christ, how He would die on the cross at Passover. It tells you also about the outpouring of the Spirit in Acts chapter 2, Pentecost, prophesied of that. But it also prophesies of the second work and the second coming, if you will, of Christ. And that's the feast days in the autumn. September, October. That's where it's prophesied. And if we have any understanding of this second phenomenon, we have to understand it in terms of the feast days. Otherwise, we're going to get into all sorts of ridiculous doctrines that have pervaded the church today when they don't know anything about the law or how the law was prophetic. Leviticus 26:13, I am the Lord your God which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their bondmen, and I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you go upright. But if you will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments. Now, here's what he's saying. In verse 13 he says, I'm the one who broke your bondage at Passover, and I freed you from Egypt. I made you Christians, in other words, right? But if you Christians will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments, in other words, if you won't be obedient, now we have a problem. Here is what's going on. And if you shall despise my statutes, it's what the New Testament calls lawlessness, anomia, or if your soul abhor my judgments, God says to that if somebody steals, he has to restore, not be thrown in jail. And what does the church want? They want people to be thrown in jail and throw away the key. What? Where do you find that in the Bible? You see? In other words, they abhor God's judgments. God's judgments are corrective in nature. Man's judgments, like prison sentences, destroy people. We've got quite a good prison ministry going here. We see it firsthand of how the prison system destroys people. It does not rehabilitate them, it destroys them. Every nation seems to want to have prisoners. They always want to set people in prison instead of saying, hey, look, you stole this, now you have to repay your victim that. Double restitution, normally. Well, then he works off his debt instead of having to rot in a prison somewhere where we have to house him and feed his family while he's in prison and, you know, and pay for his lawyer and ours too, and we get robbed 16 times. God's system is very inexpensive, and it teaches them to work off their debt rather than to steal. But you see, we do, as a people, abhor God's statutes, or despise his statutes and abhor his judgments. And that's why we've had these problems. And that's why they have to keep building bigger and better and more prisons. And it costs billions and billions and billions of dollars just to build them, to say nothing of utilizing them. But he says, if you abhor my judgments so that you will not do all my commandments, but you break my covenant, I also will do this unto you. I will appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning egg. What is that word actually? I'm sure it's old English, isn't it? Anyway, it has to do with sickness. That shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. Verse 17, and I will set my face against you, and you shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when none pursue you. You'll go into Korea, and you'll flee when none pursue you. I mean, you go into Vietnam, and you win the war, but you win the battles, but you lose the war. None are pursuing you, but you run anyway. Be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you. Boy, isn't that a mouthful today. You realize that the people that God has set up over us are people who hate us? Why do you suppose they hate us? Because God handpicked them, that's why. He handpicked them over us. We always get exactly what we deserve. We get the type of leadership that manifests the heart of the church. That's what we get. The people want to do these things. We elect people that are just like us. Just like we want Saul to reign over us. We want a king just like us. Like the nations. And boy, do we get it. Verse 18, and if you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sins. Now that's interesting too, because in the book of Daniel and Revelation, this term times or 7 times deals with a period of 2,520 years. A time being 360 prophetic days or 360 prophetic years. 7 times would be 2,520 years, which is the time period that we're talking about. It's really a time of judgment. That's why when the house of Israel went into captivity in 745 BC, that captivity began to come to an end in 1776, AD. Verse 19, and I will break the pride of your power and will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass, and your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits. Now this isn't just physical fruit. We're also dealing with the birthing of the man-child. Spiritual fruits as well. The fruits of the Spirit. These are the things that becomes more and more scarce in the land as we turn away from Him and think that we have a better idea on God. And if you'll walk contrary unto me and will not hearken unto me, I will bring 7 times more plagues upon you according to your sins. I will also send wild beasts among you, which shall rob you of your children and destroy your cattle and make you few in number, and your highways shall be desolate. And if you will not be reformed by me by these things, but will walk contrary unto me, then will I also walk contrary unto you, and will punish you yet 7 times for your sins. You get the picture here? Verse 28. Then I will walk contrary unto you also in fury, and I, even I, will chastise you 7 times for your sins. You shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters shall you eat. Ooh. That actually occurred in at least one story in the Old Testament, in the siege of Samaria. The famine was so great that they were eating their children. Oh, I guess that was a little bit before the photographers. But anyway, they were all there ready to witness these great things happening. But that's not what God was talking about. I'm surprised they didn't stone Haggai for being a false prophet here. You know, nothing ever seems to happen exactly the way we think it's going to happen. But that's the way it is. Nonetheless, Haggai's prophecy was true. It was for another time. It was true. Those people who built this temple were prophesying without even knowing it. But this message, even more so, is for us. The evidence that the time is past building this temple is evident when you just look out and see what's going on in the world and in the church. They're putting their money into a hole, you know, a bag filled with holes. They sow much and they reap little. No, I know, it's not so much in a physical sense, but it is in a spiritual sense. I know that in one case, in one very striking example, people send millions of dollars to the Israeli state for the conversion of the Jews over there. It probably takes 10 to 15 million dollars to convert one Jew. Now, this isn't exactly cost effective in my book. Why don't they send the money to somewhere where it's going to do a little bit of good? Where every dollar they can convert somebody, you know? There are much more productive fields around the world than that piece of real estate over there. But they feel obligated to do that. Okay. I still think that they're putting their wages into a bag full of holes. I still think that they looked for much and lo, it came to little. Then when they brought it home, I did blow upon it. And the question is why? It's because of mine house that is laid waste. This process really began in 1986 in a prophetic way. And we've been, 1986 to 87, the foundations were laid. But what happens then? Actually, it was very interesting. I won't get into the whole story, but we had a very interesting prophetic word that occurred on December 18, 1987, where the Lord said, "This day I lay the foundation stone." This was 2,520 years after the original foundation stone was laid, about the same time. It was in December. He says it's the 24th day of the ninth month, Haggai 2, verse 10, and in verse 18, dates it. And we know that that occurred at that time. And so, basically, now we didn't know this at the time, back in 87. We were totally ignorant of these things. Nonetheless, there was a very interesting time there when, by prophetic decree, December 18, 1987, the foundation stone was laid. And then nothing else happened after that. Everything seemed to fall apart. The opposition came. Everybody stopped working on that. And there was various situations that occurred. And here we are now, 14 years later, or almost. The year 2001 will be 14 years later, and the word is going to go forth again. Time to rebuild. And what is the evidence that it's time? Well, take a look at the past number of years. Look at the drought, the spiritual drought that has occurred or that has continued on in the land. Look at the bag full of holes. Look at the sowing much and reaping little. And what you do get, you bring back home, and tornado comes through and blows on it, and you end up with nothing. This is the evidence that Haggai brings forth, and the reason is we have violated his law. The reason is we have despised his statutes and abhorred his judgments. The whole church is sick from head to foot, as Isaiah says. It's sick because it just does not want to follow his law. So he says, therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. Spiritually speaking, if the dew is stayed from heaven, that's also a part of the law. The dew is stayed from heaven. The dew is that which comes down. It's really dealing with the Spirit of God coming down from heaven. And the earth stayed from her fruit. You see, we are to produce fruit unto God. He is interested in the fruits of the Spirit. That's why God is sowing seed in this earth. It is to bring forth a harvest of fruit. And that fruit is ultimately the fruits of the Spirit, which He wants. Or you can think of it as the fruit of the womb, if you will, in terms of God's bringing forth the man-child in the earth, the sons of God, those who are in the image of God. He's bringing forth children or sons. He is wanting to reproduce Himself in the earth. And that's the whole point of the Feast of Tabernacles. In other words, because we have violated this law and abhorred it instead, we do not know anything about the Feast of Tabernacles, nor do we experience it in our lives. The Feast of Tabernacles was the only feast day where the law was read. It was mandatory that the law be read at the Feast of Tabernacles. You're going to look that up in Nehemiah chapter 8. When they observed the law, or when they observed the Feast of Tabernacles in that chapter, Ezra stood up and he read the law to the people and showed them what it meant. And boy, did they have a revival at that time. The people stood there for hours upon hours and heard the law. So essentially, the drought is a spiritual outpouring drought. And since 1986, when the spiritual outpouring was first manifested, or could have happened theoretically, if the church had declared a jubilee at the time, which they didn't, we could have had the outpouring of the Spirit. Or let me put it this way, that was the will of God. But that wasn't the plan. God's plan and God's will are often two different things. The will was declare the jubilee in October of 96 or 86, but his plan was not going to give them the insight to do this yet. Their heart is not right yet, and it's not the time. It has to await a further time according to the patterns that were laid down way back here in Haggai, Ezra, Nehemiah, and so on. So I believe that that's what's happening at this point. But it remains for us, and I believe that God is now giving us the insight to know the times and seasons whereby we can do His will. You see, if we haven't heard, how can we do? We can't do what we haven't heard. Therefore, we must hear and see what He is doing so that we can do the will of our Father. We can do like Jesus did. He does only what He hears His Father. He says what He hears His Father say. And He does what He sees His Father do. That, of course, is our goal. Haggai 1. Let's finish up this chapter. Verse 12. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people. And that term, by the way, is a prophetic term also. The remnant of the people deals with the remnant of Israel in Elijah's day, the 7,000, you know, that did not bow the knee to Baal. And it also deals with the remnant throughout the book of Isaiah, where he talks about the remnant shall return. Shehar Jashub is the Hebrew, and that was also one of Isaiah's children. He named him, the remnant shall return. And it's dealing with the elect, or the remnant. It deals with the overcomers, in other words. And so these people who had this small minority, this 49,000 and some, you know, the number of Jubilee, who had returned to the land, leaving the millions back in Babylon, who decided life was too good to leave. This remnant that returned was a type and a shadow of the overcomers. You see? So they are called the remnant of the people. It says they obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord did their God had sent him. And the people did fear before the Lord, so they were obedient here. Then spake Haggai, the Lord's messenger, in the Lord's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith the Lord. Now that's probably an abbreviated word, but that's the essence of it. I am with you. And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and did the work of the house of the Lord of hosts, their God. In the 24th day of the 6th month, in the 2nd year of Darius the king. So, this would be, they began this work on the 24th day of the 6th month, whereas the word came to Haggai on the 1st day of the 6th month, if you look in chapter 1, verse 1. So, on the 24th day they came to do the work. And then, of course, in chapter 2, it begins in the 7th month, in the 21st day of the month, came the word of the Lord saying. And that was the 7th day of the Feast of Tabernacles. So this word came the day before the 8th day of Tabernacles in that year. I think our time is just about up here. Yeah, we came to a good stopping place. We'll start on chapter 2. This is a good stopping place here, and we'll do chapter 2 next time.